You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We're going to be talking today to Diane Ravitch. She's a research professor of education at New York University and a historian of education. She is founder and president of the Network for Public Education, and she's author of a number of best-selling books on education, including The Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools, and The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush and was a member of the National Assessment Governing Board during the Clinton administration. She's won many awards and honors and is an internationally respected authority on education. An interesting piece of her story is that she was a longtime political conservative and supported the Republican education initiatives that she now rejects, as you'll hear about in this podcast. About a decade ago, she began to see that those initiatives just were not working, and she had the honesty and courage to say so, and ever since, she's been a vocal advocate for public education. She will be in Santa Fe this Wednesday, the 11th of April, at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. Welcome, Diane Ravitch.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So your work brings attention to the big problems facing public schools, and apparently they're not the problems that we hear about in the media when people talk about the crisis in our schools. How are public schools actually doing, traditional public schools, as opposed to charter schools, in terms of measurable things like test scores, graduation rates, and so on?
Well, public schools are doing as well as they've ever done. In fact, I argue in my last book, Reign of Error, that public schools are actually doing better today than they've ever done in history. They enroll everybody who applies. They are not segregated. They include kids with disabilities. And the test scores today, and I'm talking nationally, the test scores are higher than they've ever been. And the graduation rates are higher than they've ever been, and the dropout rate is the lowest it's ever been. So test scores are doing, on all of these measures, that public schools are doing very well. Typically, public schools outperform charter schools, and the few charter schools that have high performance are charter schools that kick out students that they don't want and don't accept the kids with disabilities.
We are now witnessing this movement, which is the charter school movement, to essentially privatize public schools. Now, there have always been private schools in the U.S., but the privatization of public schools started around the 1950s as a response to the desegregation of public schools when the Brown versus Board of Education decision came down in the Supreme Court. Explain this history to us.
Well, the Brown decision said that segregation could never be equal, and that even if you equalize the spending, it was wrong to segregate children by race. And so the Brown decision of 1954 struck down the laws requiring segregation in 17 southern and border states. And consequently, the response to that decision by southern governors and deep south states was, we want school choice. We want kids to go to whatever school they want to and have the public money follow them. So this is what's different. Private schools with private money have always been part of the American scene. Religious schools with private money have always been part of the American scene. What is new in the recent past has been the idea that school choice is somehow a good thing, because what we know that what happens with school choice, and this is true in other countries, is that it increases segregation because like goes with like, and it makes public schools, which still enroll the overwhelming majority of students, it makes them poor. It takes money directly away from 90% of the kids to fund the education of the 2 or 3% who leave the public schools. So this is, in effect, a fairly recent phenomenon, even though it started in the late 1950s, early 1960s. I mean, the irony is that the term school choice has been stigmatized for decades. People in education didn't even refer to school choice because it was synonymous with, we do not want to desegregate. We do not want kids from another race in our white schools. And so it's only in the past 15 or 20 years since the charter movement picked up steam, and then now we have the voucher movement. The charter and voucher movements are essentially the same. It's about sending public money to privately managed schools and to religious schools, and that can only harm the public schools where 90% of the kids are enrolled.
There seems to be a real gap between what people want and what's happening. I mean, the school privatization movement of 60 years ago really didn't take off because the vast majority of the public was supportive of public schools. And people still do support, majorities support public schools. But that support has eroded as the support for government as a whole, you know, the whole concept of government has eroded. And this is due in significant part to political movements that call themselves education reform, but in fact have other agendas that are really not what normal people would think of when you say education reform. What's going on?
What's happening is that there is a very powerfully funded movement of libertarians who are funded basically by billionaires. And the billionaires, like the Koch brothers and the DeVos family, don't want to pay taxes. They would like to strangle government in a bathtub, as one of their spokesmen once said, and have everyone get public funding to do whatever they want to do. But they don't want environmental regulation. They don't want gun control regulation. They don't want public schools. Anything that's public, they're opposed to. They are great exponents of privatization. And in the education sphere, what they have done is to lead a 25 or 30-year campaign to say our public schools are failing, when in fact they're not failing. As I said before, they're actually doing very well and far better than most charter schools. But they have continued to say, well, look at this test score, look at the international test scores, and they keep bringing up whatever negative thing they can about public schools, and their goal is to destroy public schools and replace it with private school choice. And their ultimate goal is to reduce funding so that they don't have to pay taxes. And behind all of this is a shadowy group called ALEC, A-L-E-C, the American Legislative Exchange Council. It is funded by the Koch brothers, by the DeVos family, and by major corporations. And its purpose is to privatize everything that is now public, including Medicare and Social Security and public education, to get rid of unions and to reduce the standards for entering into the teaching profession.
And so all of those things are things that, if they were explained up front, probably most Americans would say, no way, I'm not behind that. How do they sell it?
Well, they sell it because they have so much money. And the organization that I'm involved in, the Network for Public Education, is about to put out a report about the number of billionaires who have been pouring large amounts of money into state and local school board elections all over the country. And when a state holds a referendum about school choice, you can expect millions of dollars to come pouring in from these very wealthy people, from the Walton family who own Walmart, from the DeVos family, from various other billionaires, Silicon Valley billionaires, all of whom have bought into the idea that privatization is a good thing. When you explain it to people, they say, well, that's not what I want. But it never gets explained. It just becomes something that gets a minute's attention on the radio, and the advertising will be overwhelmingly paid for by the Koch brothers. There's a referendum that will be held. I hope it's going to be held in Arizona, right next door to you, because the legislature has been expanding the voucher program. They've never put it to the voters. They just, every time they have the opportunity, they make the voucher program larger and larger. And finally, last year when they said it would be universal, parents were able to gather over 100,000 signatures to put a referendum on the ballot about whether to expand vouchers. And the Koch brothers and the DeVos family sent in lawyers to try to knock the referendum off the ballot. Now, the reason they want to knock the referendum off the ballot is they're terrified of democracy. If people understand what the referendum is about, that it's about protecting public schools, vouchers lose. And there have been 20 state referenda about whether to change the state constitution to allow vouchers. And these referendums have always been defeated, and that's why the Koch brothers want to knock the Arizona referendum off the ballot. The most recent referendum on vouchers was in Florida, where Jeb Bush tried to change the state constitution. It was overwhelmingly defeated. It was even called a religious liberty amendment. Now, you have to be pretty well informed to vote against religious liberty. But in Utah, in 2007, there was a voucher referendum. And Utah is a red state. It's very conservative. And overwhelmingly, the public defeated vouchers. So what the DeVos and Koch families usually do is they try to go through the legislature and avoid going to the voters, because the voters will never support vouchers.
Very interesting. Now, I'm speaking to you from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where we have a handful of charter schools. One is an arts conservatory. There are other schools for various grades, mostly middle school and high school. There's one online school, and you write about online schools at some length in Reign of Error. But I think most of them are locally based, kind of homegrown schools. But the charter movement overall is really a profit-motivated endeavor with very little accountability. They're not overseen by local school boards in many cases. They don't have accreditation. They don't have the same standards for teachers as public schools. Yet they're using public money. How does that even work? How can they not be accountable?
Well, Michigan would be an example of that, and that's Betsy DeVos's home state. In the state of Michigan, the charter industry gets $1 billion a year without accountability. The major newspaper in the state, the Detroit Free Press, did a one-year examination of charters and came to the conclusion that more than 80% of the charters are operated directly for profit. I'm totally opposed to anything operating for profit in the education when you talk about schools, because the people who are running the school have to pay off their stockholders first, and they're taking taxpayers' money to pay off investors rather than to reduce class sizes or pay teachers, and that's wrong. So 80% of the charters in Michigan are for profit, and when the Detroit Free Press exposed that there's no accountability, the Republican-dominated legislature, which is really dominated by the money of the DeVos family, they began to talk about maybe we should have some accountability, maybe we really should check on what they're doing and close schools that are low performing and so forth. And DeVos actually fought the accountability, and the legislature backed off and decided not to have any accountability for charter schools. And once they closed down their effort to create accountability, the DeVos family handed out about $1.5 million in political contributions to the people who had been most active in blocking this. Now, I should say about charters that I don't have any problem with charters that are created by the district, because if the district feels the need to create a charter for kids who are not being served, kids that they're where they're not doing a good job, that's great. If they create a charter, especially for the arts, I guess I have a problem with that, because why don't they have the arts in every school? That's something that's a direct responsibility of the school boards. I was reading recently that there are three schools in Albuquerque that are low performing, and where the school board presented a plan to improve them, and your state superintendent said, nope, that's not good enough, because clearly what he wants to do is to hand those three low-performing schools over to a charter chain. When you begin to get charter chains coming in, and they're all over the country now, you get corporate management. And so it's like going into a Walmart, and you say, I have a problem, and they say, shop somewhere else if you have a problem. Maybe they'll try to help you solve your problem, but ultimately they'll say, if you don't like what we have, go somewhere else. Well, in a public school, your public school has to respond to you. You can talk to the principal. So I think it's very important to maintain democratic control of public schools and to not have distant corporations where the home office is in Houston or in some other state, and where they can say to you, we can't help you, go somewhere else. It's like shopping in a store. Public school is a public responsibility. It's not a consumer choice. And where people like Jeb Bush and Betsy DeVos and the Koch brothers, where they've been very effective, is trying to sell the public on the idea that picking a school is a consumer choice. As Jeb Bush said at the Republican convention in 2012, he said it's like choosing what kind of milk you want when you go to the supermarket. Do you want 1%, 2%, whole milk, chocolate milk, buttermilk? No, it's not. It's your community institution. Your taxes paid for it, and it's just like, do you have a choice of a police department? No, you have a police department. You have a fire department. You have public parks. The public does have some responsibilities, and we pay for it, and it belongs to us, and we can't allow people like Jeb Bush and the Koch brothers and the DeVos family to change us from citizens to consumers.
Well, I think this is such a great opportunity for people, for taxpayers, for citizens to really talk about the purposes of the public sector and the private sector. I mean, a robust private sector is our tax base. It provides many things far better than government can. I mean,
absolutely.
I wouldn't want to buy government issue shoes, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, there are things that government has to do and should do and does best. And I think this whole campaign to discredit government itself is so toxic. I mean, you make such a strong argument that our schools are preparing people not just for like global competition, which is fine, I guess, but also for citizenship, for actually being part of a society and improving that society.
Well, I think this is something that many people don't think about, which is, why do we pay for public schools? Why does every one of us pay taxes for public schools? You pay taxes for public schools even if you don't have children. You pay taxes for public schools if your children attend a private school. Even if your children went to public school and no longer do, you still pay taxes. Why? Because it's part of the public sphere. It's what government does. You really have to think about what is it the government does best and should do, and what is it the private sector does best. I'm reminded that many years ago I traveled in the behind the Iron Curtain where there was no private enterprise, and I came away from that experience having great appreciation for having a strong and vibrant private economy, which is clearly, this is where wealth is generated. This is where taxes come from. But when you begin to destroy the public sector, then you begin to have greater inequality. There's a book I read that I recommend to everybody called The Spirit Level, written by some British sociologists. And the thesis of the book is the more equality you have in society, the happier the society is. We have, I mean, I have to say, since you're in New Mexico, New Mexico has the highest poverty rate of any state in the country. It has the highest child poverty rate of any state in the country. If you want to know where you find low test scores, it's where there's poverty. So when you talk about, well, how do we improve our schools, and you're thinking about test scores, you have to go to the root cause. The root cause of low test scores is not the schools and it's not the teachers. It's poverty. It's poverty and it's segregation. Those are the two factors that are most closely identified with low test scores. So if you're going to avoid the addressing the root causes, you will never improve the schools. And in preparing to talk at the Lana Foundation, I've been doing a lot of research about New Mexico and its standing. And one thing I noticed is that with all of the Florida-style reforms that were introduced over the past 7 or 8 years, New Mexico hasn't moved at all in terms of the national rankings. New Mexico is one of the lowest-ranked states in the country. It's down there in some rankings below the District of Columbia, the lowest ranking urban district in the country, and even below Mississippi on some rankings. So what you find, if you just step back from all these rankings, what do they mean? What they mean is that where there's high poverty, where there's vast inequality, there's low test scores. And the cause of the low test scores has to be looked at in terms of the social situation, which is high poverty. So I'm not saying change your tax structure, but there are things that schools can do and should do, such as having early childhood education, which gives parents more opportunity to add some income to the family. But looking at how kids can get better medical care because their families can't afford it, making sure that they have access to the meals that they need to have food security. I think these are things that schools can do and should do, but the funding has to be there for them to provide both the access to medical care and the food security and the early childhood education.
Well, and you also talk about prenatal care as being part of ultimately equalizing the achievement gaps among different people, both right. In racial and economic differences.
Right. When I was writing Reign of Error, I reviewed the causes of low test scores. One of the causes is the lack of prenatal care. The U.S. has a terrible rating. I think we're somewhere tied with Somalia for access to prenatal care or actual provision of prenatal care. And that's scandalous. We're one of the richest countries in the world. And every woman who becomes pregnant should, as a matter of right, have good medical care. Because if we don't provide good medical care for pregnant women, will be paying for the care of their children for the rest of their lives. Women who don't have access to prenatal care have a disproportionate number of children who have cognitive disabilities, and they may even be institutionalized at great cost to society. So you either pay up front what's necessary, which may be a modest amount of money, or you pay later vast amounts of money to cure problems that should never have happened in the first place.
There's an argument that you write about in your book, Reign of Error, that says, well, we should fix the schools before we fix the economy, or it's no excuse, you know, poverty is not an excuse. And it seems like a false choice. We should be able to address both schools that are not doing so well and inequality and poverty. But you, at the same time, you have this situation where schools around the country in poor neighborhoods that are funded by property taxes are set up to be under-resourced because there isn't as much money in those districts as there are in wealthier districts that have wonderful schools with lots of amenities. What is your vision for addressing that structural piece of school inequality?
I think that the fundamental reason we have public education is to make sure that our kids are well prepared for citizenship. And that means that we as a society have a responsibility to make sure that the schools actually have the funding they have to do the job that we expect of them. That means that the state and the federal government should play an equalizing function. You cannot expect schools to be funded by local property taxes and to have equality of educational opportunity. I've been to many suburban districts and been absolutely astonished by the kind of luxurious accommodations in their schools, the beautiful auditoriums, the beautiful physical education facilities, the small class sizes, and on with the wonderful advantages. And then you go into a school in the urban districts and you see that they're barely scraping by with large classes. And these are the schools that have the kids with multiple disabilities, kids who are English language learners. These kids who have the highest needs need the most resources, and that's what state and federal governments are supposed to do. That's why federal aid to education was passed in the first place in 1965, which was to try to at least make a start towards equalizing funding. But right now, the focus on choice has been a smokescreen, and it may be a purposeful smokescreen because the people who call themselves reformers are not really reformers. They're privatizers, and they are offering privatization as an alternate to actually fixing the problems. Opening charter schools does not help public schools. It just takes funding away from public schools. Offering vouchers takes funding away from public schools. So you're actually worsening the problems by introducing school choice, firstly, because most of the choices are inferior to the public schools, and secondly, because you're defunding the public schools at the same time that you're offering choice, which will be used only by a very small minority of kids.
Privatization is going on across our society. And so, for example, when prisons are privatized, they tend to cut costs in order to make more profits. So there are fewer rehabilitation and vocational programs and so on. The quality of prisons goes down. People come out of prison less prepared to reenter society. What are the parallels when public schools are privatized?
There's a very good publication, and it's online. It's called In the Public Interest, which tracks privatization across many sectors. And you can find examples where public libraries have been privatized, where hospitals have been privatized, where all kinds of medical care have been privatized, and it has not improved the quality of service. And when you think about it, it's impossible to improve the quality of service by cutting costs. If you give people an incentive to kick out the hardest cases, which is what happens in education, where the charter schools, and this may not be true in New Mexico, but it's certainly true in most of the cities where the charters are located, they do not have an incentive to serve the kids with high needs because they cost more. They don't want kids with severe disabilities. They are kicked out and pushed back to the public schools. They don't want the kids who don't speak English unless that's their focus as a charter school. But most of the charter schools do not accept the same proportion of kids who are English language learners. This would be a particular issue in New Mexico because the majority of students in the state are Hispanic, and many of them do need extra help in learning English. But those are not the kids that the charter schools want. The charter schools want the kids who are likely to produce high test scores. So when you introduce the profit motive, it becomes an incentive, and this is the nature of privatization, to cut costs and to take the likely to succeed students and likely to succeed patients. I remember reading a study in medicine where cardiac specialists in a privatized medical system were turning away risky patients because they wanted to keep their score up, that their patients survived. So if someone came in with a very serious heart condition, they would turn them away and say, go to the public facility. Don't come here. We don't want you to die on our watch. That's not good medicine, and it's not good education when you say we're only going to take the students most likely to succeed.
There's also such a potential for corruption, because if you have these corporate schools receiving public money and then turning around to lobby elected officials, it's hard to understand how that could even be legal.
Well, it is hard, and it's very frustrating because I live in a state where that kind of lobbying goes on all the time. I live in New York. In New York, the lobbyists and the billionaires, the Wall Street people who want privatization, have given large sums of money to our governor. And so the governor has become a great advocate for charter schools, and he pushes through major appropriations for charter schools, forces the public schools to give them free space, even though they can afford to pay rent, and they don't. But they are paying off politicians. The same has happened in Ohio and in Michigan and in many other states where the charter operators, even when they're not operating for profit, are supported by these incredibly wealthy people like Bill Gates, like Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, like Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix, like the Fisher family, the owners of the Gap and the Old Navy. And I could just go with billionaire after billionaire, million after millionaire, and all these Wall Street hedge fund types who are committed to privatization. And they're not in it for the money, but they just think that the private sector works better, and they really don't understand or care about public education because either they themselves have never been in a public school or they simply prefer the private sector. But they give a lot of money to politicians. I mean, the California Charter School Association is now the most powerful lobby in the state of California, and they have a lot of legislators in their pocket. So it's a very uneven playing field because public schools don't have that kind of money to put into lobbying operations. Teachers' unions don't have that kind of money. All of their operating funds come not from government or from Wall Street, but from their members' dues. So it's very unfair. And then the other thing the charter lobby does and has done in many states, including New York, is that they'll go to legislative hearings and they'll bus in the children and their parents and their staff all wearing identical T-shirts. And they'll all say, we want equality, we want more charter schools. And they're lobbying for more charter schools, but they're doing it on the taxpayers' dime. And it's very effective when you pack a hearing with 1,000 kids and parents in matching T-shirts. And the other kids, who may be a million children, don't have kids there in T-shirts because if they sent their kids to the legislative hearings, the principals would be fired. It's not legal for public school principals to do that, but charter schools do this all the time. It's part of their arsenal of political games that they play.
Well, and they're playing both sides of the game. And on the one hand, they're saying, well, we are public schools. And they call themselves public charter schools when it's convenient for them to represent themselves that way. But when it comes time to accountability, they say, no, we're a private corporation.
Right. This has happened again and again. And we have probably the most successful charter chain in the nation in New York City. And they get public space for free. And they say they're public schools. But if you try to get access to their data, it's like going on a detective search to try to find out what the attrition rate was. On my blog, I just posted someone has finally identified that their attrition rate is about 80%. 80% of the kids who started in first grade are gone, and they say that this is a highly selective school. They don't even allow kids to enter the school after third grade. So what kind of a public school is it that says after third grade our enrollment is closed? And then they begin getting rid of the kids who have low test scores, and then they can boast to the world about their test scores. And they raise millions and millions of dollars from these billionaires who will say, I'm going to give $5 million this year, $10 million this year. Public schools could never do that. It's not legal. But charter schools will say we're public schools to get public money. But then when it comes to following the rules don't apply to them. They can send kids out to lobby for them. Public schools can't do that. That is unacceptable politicization. They can hire teachers who are not certified. And in some states, that's quite okay. It differs from state to state about what the rules are. But since they're so politically active in the state legislatures, they're usually able to bend the rules to their own benefit. There are even states where the states say we don't allow for-profit charters. And then there are nonprofit charters being run by for-profit corporations. They're called EMOs, Education Management Organizations. And they basically get all the money and make all the decisions, and they have a nonprofit board.
I once met a woman who was going to Harvard Business School, and she, this was many years ago, before all of this really became known, the stuff you're talking about, and she was saying to me that what she was seeing in school was people figuring out how to use their very well-honed business skills to move money from the taxpayers to their own pockets. In other words, they were seeing the public coffers, education and otherwise, as essentially a huge well of capital that would never dry up, that they could siphon off. And that's what this looks like to me. And they see public school money as business opportunity, and their market strategy is that they're quote-unquote reformers.
Well, unfortunately, this has been the story for at least the past decade, and I began getting emails inviting me because I had, in the past, as you know, I had been on the conservative side, and I was a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and then in 2008, 2009, I began to kind of say, wait a minute, none of this makes any sense. But consequently, I'm on a lot of mailing lists for conservative and right-wing websites that send me these invitations to things like how to make a buck off public education. There is a new world of people called edupreneurs. They're entrepreneurs who've entered education, who have no education background, but they see the public funding as a new market that has to be exploited. Arizona State University has an annual conference of people looking to make money off public education. Right now, the holy grail is in the edtech world, and the edtech world has one overriding goal, which is making money. The thing that they're all trying to figure out is how to replace teachers because teachers cost so much. So right now they're into blended learning, and blended learning means time on computers, but the ultimate goal is when we don't need really need any teachers at all, we just have tech facilitators. So that would be, I guess, their ideal classroom, but they keep trying and trying. Mark Zuckerberg has something called the Summit Learning Platform, which is moving more and more kids onto computers. There's Rocket Ship Charter Chain, which where kids spend about half their day on computers. And another entrepreneur from Google created something called Alt School. But none of these have been successful. But their only measure of success is test scores, not a good education.
I have to say, and both of my parents were educators, that one of the underlying attitudes here, and you just talked about it, I mean, the idea that you can just replace teachers, it's such a profound disrespect for teachers. You've written about something called the parent trigger, and that is the idea that if enough parents sign a petition, they can take over a school. And the very concept that parents or hedge fund managers or politicians or entrepreneurs know more about education than teachers, it's hard to think of another profession that's comparable. I mean, you point out that nobody would say that patients know more about medicine than doctors, even if there's a lousy hospital, or that motorists know more about engineering than engineers, even if there's a bridge collapse.
Right.
Why are teachers, why is education so vulnerable to being treated this way?
Well, I guess that education is vulnerable in the first instance because it's a female profession. There are a lot of people moving into this thinking, well, teachers don't have much of a voice and can easily be bullied. And now we have, as the Secretary of Education, someone who's never been a teacher, never, to my knowledge, had anything to do with public schools, and is an advocate for privatization of public schools. And that's a tremendous sign of disrespect for public education. But even if you think about the legislatures typically make decisions that affect what should be taught and occasionally how it should be taught, and very few of them have ever been educators. So teachers have not gotten the respect that they deserve, and very frankly, no education decisions should be made without the participation of the people who are going to have to do the work, which is the teachers. But I think the underlying disrespect is that there is an attack on the teaching profession itself. And I mentioned before this organization called ALEC. If you want to learn more about it, go to a website called ALEC Exposed. And they have model legislation there that aims to decertify teachers, to say that anyone can teach. And that takes us not forward to the future, but back to the early 19th century, before there was any such thing as teacher certification, before there were any standards for teaching. I mean, the teaching should be a profession. You should have to spend years preparing for it. The most successful education system, in my view, in the world is in Finland, and it's been written about quite a lot. In Finland, it's very difficult to become a teacher. There are only 8 teacher training institutions in the country. It's a small country. It's only 5 million people, so it would be like one of our states. But it's very difficult to get into a teacher training institution, and unless you have gone through 5 years of the teacher training program, you can't teach in Finland. There is no Teach for America in Finland. But in this country, Teach for America has had an enormous impact in terms of the money it's raised, the money it has in the bank, which is about $300 million, and the inexperience of its teachers. Your state commissioner comes from Teach for America. This would not be permitted in Finland. First of all, he wouldn't be allowed to teach. And secondly, he wouldn't be allowed to be a principal or a superintendent or a state superintendent, because in Finland, education is a profession. It's not something for amateurs.
And it's on a level with doctors and lawyers as being a respected
right.
and well-paid profession that is also gender equal, if I understand correctly.
Let me put it this way. In Finland, the teaching profession is considered equal to every other profession, and the teachers have enormous autonomy. There are no standardized tests in Finland. The schools are considered a standardized test-free zone. The children are treated with respect and with love. There's a recess after every single class where teachers get a few minutes break and students get to run outside and have unsupervised play because they need the exercise. Physical education is a very important part of the school day, as are the arts and music. And, you know, when I visited there, the schools I visited were very proud to show off their arts programs and also their physical activity that the children did. And the warm meals that every child had, it wasn't just for poor kids, it was for everybody, and they were free. I mean, this is what a society that cares about its children does. In this country, the state after state has been cutting its budget in education, and for the first time in many years, we're beginning to see wildcat teacher strikes, because, first of all, they have to stand up for themselves as professionals, and they have to be able to earn a living wage in order to teach. But they also care about their kids, and they see that their kids are being cheated. So they have a double interest in saying, we won't stand for this anymore.
There's a real political challenge because both, for example, the George W. Bush and the Obama eras supported the privatization of education and charter schools. You had No Child Left Behind. You had the Race to the Top. Who's standing for public schools, public teachers, and our children?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time since my conversion book came out, which was The Death and Life of the Great American School System. And what I said in that book was, I've been a conservative for the last, I don't know how, 20, 25 years. And everything that I've advocated, I've now learned, is not working and will only ruin education. And so I have, since then, which was 2010, I've traveled to most states in the country and been in search of who are the governors who are standing up for public schools, who are the senators, who are the congressmen. And I have to tell you, there are very few. I mean, they exist, and I have seen here and there some really wonderful programs. Believe it or not, the best program thus far that I've come across is in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where anonymous donors stepped forward and said, if you attend the Kalamazoo Public Schools, you will go to any state university you want tuition-free if you graduate and get accepted into college. And it's had a dramatic dynamic effect on the entire community and on the schools. Everybody is now collaborating to help kids learn, to make sure that they're ready to learn. Enrollment has increased. It's been a hugely positive impact on the community and the teachers and the parents and the kids, because kids know that they will be able to enter college and finish college debt-free. This is remarkable, but they have to do their part. But that's one of the few things I've seen where I can say something really good is happening. But it's very hard to break free of the spell of testing, accountability, and punishment that has been in place in this country since 2001, when No Child Left Behind was passed. No Child Left Behind was a massive failure. Obama's Race to the Top was a massive failure. And we have spent billions and billions and billions of dollars trying to raise test scores and trying to privatize schools without seeing any beneficial impact.
Good schools, as you point out, are not a pipe dream. I mean, not only do they exist in virtually all of Europe, in other countries, Finland, as you mentioned, but also many of us who went to school in the era of the Great Society programs had terrific public schools. I loved my public schools when I was a kid, and they had arts and music and drama and all that, and recess and PE. What would need to happen? First of all, tell us your vision for robust public schools that really do educate students to become citizens. And what would it take for that to happen?
Well, I have to say that we have just recently seen an example of what happened and where there is a great public school, and I'm sure it's not, there are many more like it, and that's the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. I mean, when you look at the kids who have come out, they've not graduated, they're still students there, but when you look at their eloquence, their poise, their intelligence, when you see them debate senators and congressmen and governors, and they're smarter than the elected officials. This is a school that has an active debate club, an active drama society, and the kids are getting civics and history and government and foreign languages and all the background they need to be good citizens. And they are being the best of good citizens because they have experienced the worst of American society. And they've come forward and within 6 weeks organized an incredible national and international protest movement, which I don't think is going to go away anytime soon. But there are many more schools like that. I've visited schools like that. I've seen this, and I live in both in New York City, but also in a distant exurb from New York City. And the schools there are spectacular, probably. I don't know if their scores are as spectacular as they are, but they're amazing, and the kids are amazing. And they have the same kind of qualities of intelligence, thoughtfulness, presence of mind. And it comes from having a well-rounded liberal arts education and many opportunities, not just test scores, in which to become successful. And I'd say my vision of a good public school would be one that has that kind of a solid curriculum, that has experienced teachers, that respects teachers, a community that cares enough about its schools to make sure that it's properly funded so that every child has a chance. If I would say, where do we change things? We change, and this is not easy, but it's doable, by getting rid of the federal mandate for annual testing. I could go on at length, and I have in my books, about the defects of standardized testing. There was a book that came out last fall from one of the nation's leading testing experts. It's called The Testing Charade, Pretending to Make Schools Better, by Daniel Koretz. Daniel Koretz is a Harvard testing expert, and he said all this emphasis on standardized testing is simply destructive. It's pretending to make schools better. You can't judge schools by test scores because the standardized tests ultimately only reflect family income. You can look at any standardized test given in the world, whether it's an international test or a state standardized test, and what you're measuring is where are the rich families and where are the poor families. And you'll occasionally find rich kids who get low scores, but that's an anomaly. And you'll occasionally find poor kids who get really high scores. That, too, is an anomaly. The standardized tests are a measure of family education and family income. And why in the world are we doing that? It's such a weak measure. If we want to know which kids are college ready, the best predictor of that is student grade point average over 4 years. And this is what study after study has shown. It's not the SAT, it's not the ACT, but grade point average. So I think we should stop wasting billions of dollars on standardized testing. I could go on at length about how the Common Core has reinforced some of the worst tendencies towards standardization and the reliance on standardized testing. But start with getting rid of the standardized testing and give teachers the respect and autonomy to make their own tests as they do in Finland, as they did when I was a student in public school in Houston, Texas. Teachers know their students best, and the standardized test makers don't.
Do you see this movement against privatization in public schools, do you see that growing?
Absolutely. I see resistance groups actually in every state in the country. Take as an example, there was an effort to pass a referendum in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has long been the most successful state in the country in terms of test scores on the national tests, which are not the high-stakes standardized tests that I've been talking about, where kids are punished or teachers are punished for their scores. But Massachusetts is a very successful state. They introduced charters many years ago, but in very small numbers. So the charter advocates decided they would have a state referendum to lift the cap on charters. And in came money from Mayor Bloomberg of New York City to Massachusetts, from the Walton family of Arkansas, from hedge fund managers in Connecticut and New York and elsewhere, to try to lift the cap in Massachusetts. And when it went to a vote, it was overwhelmingly defeated by 2-1. So I see this kind of resistance. Whenever you go to the voters, voters defend their public schools. And this is why the billionaires and the people who are promoting privatization will do everything possible to avoid a referendum because they don't have public support. Just to give you another small example, but important, Indiana has one of the most expansive voucher programs in the country. It has a student enrollment of 1 million children and 35,000 used vouchers. But the 35,000 were almost all children who had previously been enrolled in non-public schools. So it was just a subsidy to kids who were going to go to religious schools anyway, and it has taken millions of dollars away from the more than 90% who still go to public schools. This didn't go to the voters. The voters would never have said, yes, we want to divert tens of millions, hundreds of millions to support 3% of the kids going to vouchers to religious schools. But this has been the modus operandi of the privatization movement, which is to avoid public votes and to go through the legislature, give campaign contributions to legislators, and then get their program enacted.
There's much more to talk about, and I highly recommend Diane Ravitch's book, The Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. She is research professor of education at New York University and a historian of education and the author of several best-selling books. You can find out more at dianeravitch.com, DianeRavitch. And for our local listeners, she will be here in Santa Fe, New Mexico on Wednesday, the 11th of April at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and I really look forward to being in Santa Fe.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.